The intersection of endurance sport, health, fitness, and life. Challenging conventional ideas and empowering people with the science of self-propelled motion. This is the Endurance Experience Podcast, hosted by Tony Rich.
Welcome back to the Endurance Experience Podcast. I hope all my friends, particularly the ones in the Northern Hemisphere, are enjoying fall. Fall marathons are well underway. And we say bye to the summer for many of us. On this podcast, we have a special treat for all of you swimmers, and particularly open water swimmers. So if swimming, or particularly open water swimming, is your thing, this podcast is for you. If not, we'll see you next podcast. But even for you non-swimmers, this podcast is very interesting, as I have a conversation with one of the world's best open water swimmers ever. He is Alex Meyer. And he is a former American competition swimmer who specialized in open water and long-distance swimming. He won a gold medal at the 2010 FINA World Open Water Swimming Championships in the 25-kilometer open water event. He was a member of the 2012 United States Olympic team. And so he joins the second Olympian to be featured on the Endurance Experience, along with Meb Keflezighi. And so Alex placed 10th in the 10-kilometer open water event in 2012 in the Olympics. That's phenomenal. And so I wanted to have Alex on. He and I live in the same region, and I thought it'd be interesting to have a conversation with someone like him, just so we can understand the origin story of someone who was able to be successful at the open water swim event, and also give some advice to triathletes and other people who want to progress in open water swimming. So we talk about Alex's origin story with swimming and what drew him to open water versus pool competition swimming. And we talk about some of the swimming accomplishments he's most proud of. And we talk about his decision to train in the Ivy League at Harvard. And some of the ins and outs of being a Division I swimmer. We talk about the Olympic trials and what the Olympic trials is like for open water swimming. And this will be particularly interesting to anyone who feels like they want to go that route. And then we talk quite a bit about the 2012 Olympics, and Alex discusses his feelings about his performance at the Olympics and whether or not he has any regrets. And then we have a discussion about becoming a better swimmer, and particularly becoming a better open water swimmer. And Alex gives his recommendations to open water swimmers and triathletes. Just swimming better, getting more experience, and then getting beyond the fear of open water. And finally, Alex sums up his swimming experience and talks about what he does now to channel some of the competitive drive and what he's excited about, particularly in swimming today, and who he is excited about, whether it be in the prior Olympics or the forthcoming Olympics. And he actually developed a pretty sophisticated swimming ranking approach and an algorithm. So I asked him to tell me all about it. It's marathonswimrankings.com. The link is in the show notes. So without further delay, I give you Olympic swimmer Alex Meyer. All right, I am on with Alex Meyer. Thanks for coming on to the podcast, Alex.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tony.
All right. Been wanting to sit down with you for some time. Your performance in open water swimming is certainly impressive. You have several gold medals in world and national championships, and also you're an Olympian. So I wanted to talk to you about swimming and find out your background, about your origin story, why you chose open water competition versus pool competition. I want to talk about swimming in the Ivy League at Harvard, and want to talk about the Olympic trials and your experience competing as an Olympian. And I also want to get your swimming advice for all of the open water swimmers and triathletes that listen to this podcast. And I always also want to get your thoughts on who you're excited about in the swimming world currently as we look forward to another Olympics really soon. So
sounds good.
How about we start by just talking about, in your own words, what's your origin story? And particularly with swimming, how did you get involved in swimming, and what drew you to open water versus swimming in the concrete box, as we said?
Yeah. Well, kind of take it as two separate questions. I mean, I started swimming just as pretty much most kind of kids do, because their parents tell them to. I mean, both my parents were not like serious, competitive swimmers, but they were swimmers. You know, my mom swam at the University of Georgia. My dad wrestled and swam and even dove, I think, a little bit at Hobart back in the day. But even when I was growing up, they both swam, did the master's thing and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I think when my mom coached a little bit, and it kind of started out of, at least somewhat out of my mom's interest, but also necessity, based on the fact that she was on the pool deck coaching a little bit, and I think it made the schedule a little bit easier. but also that she loves the sport of swimming, and so does my dad too. So I think that kind of naturally, I guess that's just what parents do.
Right.
And I started, I was about 7 years old. I started with a YMCA team in upstate New York, the Glens Falls YMCA Gators.
Nice.
Yeah. And I just, for a long time, I was not anything special. I was just a very average kid, with kind of a little extra, a little extra weight around the middle, bad technique, wanted to skip practice whenever I could, just typical, stuff. And then over time, started to just really enjoy it and have fun, and really felt good when I improved. And, they also, my parents, kind of encouraged me to do other sports and stuff too, like, mm-hmm. like soccer and t-ball, but that whole hand-eye coordination thing, the whole land sport thing, just didn't really work out. Yeah. I was not as naturally inclined towards those sports as I was towards the pool. And as time went on, I grew to love the sport and grew, and most importantly, developed goals. and decided that I wanted to be good at swimming, and then decided to therefore focus on that sport solely. So
yeah,
that's kind of the origin story. And then I guess as far as the open water kind of transition, I don't even really like to call it that much of a transition. I know you didn't use that word, but a lot of people do ask me that. It was just always something that it just kind of did. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I grew up in Ithaca, New York, which is a small town or city and at the south end of Cayuga Lake, which is one of the Finger Lakes in the central New York.
Right.
And we just, and even before that, I moved there when I was like 10, but even before that, we were my family lived up in the Glens Falls area, closer to like Adirondack kind of region.
Adirondack's nice up there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful. We still, I still spend a lot of time up there. I'm actually going up there this weekend for a friend's wedding, but, we were just always around water and lakes, and we did family vacations to Cape Cod, and we would always be around the ocean in the summers occasionally. And, being in open water was just always something that I was very comfortable with and familiar with and thoroughly enjoyed. And there are a couple of other factors that kind of contributed to me taking it a little more seriously. And that one, as I got a little bit older, you kind of start to, you know, coaches want to make young kids as well-rounded as possible. And, you know, do the sprints, do the long stuff, do IM, do all the strokes, like, because you never know what a 10-year-old kid is going to end up being. But, you know, by the age 13, 14, 15, you know, around that age, you do start to kind of specialize in certain events. And I, you know, became... I realized at some point, whether I liked it or not, that I was a distance swimmer.
Right.
The whole short twitch, fast twitch muscle fiber thing is, I just don't really have many of those. I was a distance swimmer, and to some degree, I even felt like the mile was a little bit too short for me. My coach was always harping on me to, you know, you gotta go out, you're always passing people at the end, you gotta go out faster. And, you know, I just like couldn't, a mile just always felt a little too short. So there was that component. And then also my coach growing up in Ithaca, Roy Staley, who's been coaching for the last 150 years, he would always tell the story about this woman named Claire DeBoer, who, and I believe it was 1984, swam the length of Cayuga Lake, which is about 40 miles long. And Roy's the kind of guy that if you get him going on a topic, he will just go on and on and on forever. So not only was it a good way to burn like half an hour or 45 minutes of practice time, but like I just loved bring up that topic or that story and trying to get him to tell it, because it was just this crazy story. Like I had never heard a swimming story quite like this before. Like they started in the middle of the night and she jumped off this bridge and they're swimming through the dark and she had a glow stick on her cap. And then when the daylight came and then there was a storm overnight and they had to have this sailboat drag a copper wire onto the bottom of the lake so that it would like grant that if lightning struck it, it would hit the sailboat and it would ground. And then the news was all covering this swim. And then the news helicopter showed up to take some video footage or whatever. And the fan, I guess the airflow from the propeller or from the helicopter blades were like potentially was going to disqualify the swim. And they had
call
the Coast Guard to tell them to get out of there. And it was just this whole big, long, crazy thing. I'm like, wow, that never happens in like a 200 freestyle, you know, like you don't have crazy stories like that. So I was always just fascinated with this concept of, you know, endurance swimming and open water swimming and doing these, just big, long, ballsy swims. And so that in kind of combination with coming into my own as a distance swimmer, is what kind of steered me in that direction. And I would say that the real pivotal moment for me was in 2009. I was actually, it was between my junior and senior year of college. And I got invited to the USA Swimming Select Camp for open water, which is basically they invite a bunch of fast milers that have not really done any open water stuff. And they think it's kind of a feeder program for the national team.
Yeah.
I went and did that for a week or 5 days or something like that. And Mark Workington was there, who was our 2008 Olympian. And I just learned a ton of stuff about the tactics and the strategy. And it was like a whole nother, if Roy's story about Claire was kind of one level of my mind being opened, this was like the next level.
Yeah.
And it really provided a spark where I'm like, okay, I actually think I could be really good at this. I really enjoy this. I am really energized about the idea of, you know, going to nationals and trying to get on the national team and go do some races and all that stuff. And after that camp was in the week leading up to our national championships in 2009. And I got kind of by surprise, I got fourth place and I actually finished the race and they got out and they're like, congratulations, you made the world championship team to go to Rome. I was like, awesome. I would love to go to Rome and swim a 10K. And they're like, oh, no, you, that's for the first and second place. They get to swim the 10K. You can swim the 25K if you want to go to Rome. I was like, well, okay. Wow. I literally just swam my first 10K, but sure, I'll go to Rome, swim 25K. What's 15 more?
Wow. Incredible story. Yeah. So that was the catalyst to open water. I mean, just to put that in perspective, a 10K swim. And so, you know, I just worked out the math. So that's 10,936 yards. That's a lot of swimming. And sometimes people will swim that in a week. A triathlete, say, or a master swimmer will swim that in a week.
Yeah, no flip turns either. No walls.
No walls, no flip turns. And yeah, I mean, I understand the draw. Actually interviewed on a previous podcast, a woman by the name of Chloe McCardle. She's the channel swimmer, Guinness mm-hmm. World Record holder. Yeah. And it's the same type of draw of being in the open water and swimming naturally and you know, having to worry and concern yourself with the environment, waves and things like that. There's a draw to it. Wow. So that's very interesting. Well, you swam at Harvard and what's it like swimming for a Division I college, and what went into your decision to go to Harvard versus say, you know, Stanford or Florida Gators, one of those. I'm not sure what the rankings are now or what the rankings were back then, but did that play into your decision? And what was it like swimming D1?
Okay, so let's see. So what went into the decision? I mean, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I turned down offers from all these other like, you know, top notch D1 swim programs because they were not interested in me. I'm one of those guys that just like continually progressed over time.
Uh-huh.
And I think at least for the men in swimming, like you kind of know if you're going to be like an elite athlete or not by that 18, 19 or that like 17, 18, 19 kind of time frame.
Mm-hmm.
At that age for me, I was like a good swimmer. I was like a good solid swimmer, but no one would have ever picked me to like be on a national team or let alone an Olympic team or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I would say that I continued to progress after the period where some guys start to plateau, not necessarily in terms of their times, but in terms of their rank or something, I guess you could say. And also, you know, my 1500, I also strategically, but mostly because I was interested in open water swimming, And because I knew it was like, if my goal is to make an Olympic team, like my best shot is not going to be the 1500. It's going to be the 10K because
got it.
Just candidly, the pool events are more competitive. There just are more people that do them.
Right.
So I knew that if I was going to make the team, then I had to kind of put my eggs in the open water basket. And right. It was just better suited to my natural abilities and my endurance and my interests right. and my desire to race, to like race a tactical race and like a physical race. I really loved that part of it. So anyway, back to the core question, which is how did I decide that? I mean, academics were always important to me. So I think I just picked, you know, I picked a bunch of schools that I thought would be really good academic fit for me that also had good swim programs.
Right.
And then took recruiting trips there and then kind of told myself, no matter what, you can't really make a bad choice here. Yeah. Academically, at least, which is the more important factor. And go on these trips and feel out the teams and basically wherever you feel more at home or whoever you bond with the most or whatever coach you think is you'd be better off swimming for or whatever, then kind of go with that. Just go with your gut. So I kind of just, I set it up to not possibly make a bad decision and then just go with gut.
Yeah.
From there. So that's kind of how I ended up there. And I really liked Tim Murphy, who is the coach. I really bonded with the guys on the team. I thought I love the Boston area. You know, it's far enough away from home where I felt like I could, you know, kind of create a new life and for myself and kind of be on my own and do that whole thing, but also not far enough away where, you know, it's a pain to get home for
right.
holidays and whatnot. So,
yeah. And what's a glimpse into the training? It's at peak volume, say how many yards are you doing per week? Are you doing double sessions, triple sessions?
Yep. So it would do about, we would usually do 10 swimming workouts a week and then wow. probably 4 weight room workouts a week. And then I would do some supplemental stuff on like the Vasa trainer and do it, go upstairs and do like medicine ball, Vasa trainer and jump rope stuff. So
yeah.
all in all, it's probably, I'm supposed to say that it was 20 hours of training per week, not a minute more. That's what the NCAA, kind of, limits the programs to, at least in terms of mandatory practices. But I would say it was between 25 and it was probably more like 25, 30 hours a week on 30 on like a big week. And especially after college, when I was, you know, full-time professional athlete and focusing, specifically on my sport. So,
right.
But yeah, you know, honestly, it double sessions. I think we had like Wednesday mornings off, otherwise double Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, single Wednesday, single Saturday, Sunday off. And then Sundays I'd often come in and just swim for like 20 minutes or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was more or less the schedule, which is really not that much different from any other D1 program out there.
Wow.
It's all more or less on the same kind of time commitment level. But where they kind of different programs differentiate themselves is, you know, what you do during those hours.
So. Right. Interesting. Okay. And so let's jump to the trials and talk about that experience. So how many trials have you been to?
And then let's see. So for the, let's see, I went to 2008, 12 and 16. So I went to 3 in Omaha, for pool trials. There isn't really, the open water selection process is a little more complicated because the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, basically limits that event to 25 participants. And then they delegate the responsibility of determining the start list, basically
right.
to running the qualification process. They delegate that to FINA, which is the International Federation, the international right. governing body for not just swimming, but all aquatic sports. And when I made the team, basically we select, basically our Olympic trials was actually really a world championship trials, because the first opportunity to qualify was at the world championships the summer before the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. So for example, in 2011, that was actually really our, it could be the Olympic trials if those who qualify for the 10K at world championships go to world championships and get and place in the top 10, which I did. That year for the women, I believe it was Eva Fabian and Christine Jennings, who are our top two women at nationals. They went to Shanghai, right, and they did not finish in the top 10 in the 10K, which was the first, call it, batch of athletes that get selected by FINA. Because they did not qualify, because I qualified, no other men could qualify. That's it. That's your one swimmer.
That's it. One swimmer.
Yeah. Wow. Because no American women qualified, then the process kind of starts all over again the following spring, and there's this kind of one-off FINA Olympic qualifier event. So in that case, you could say that our national championships that year were the Olympic trials, but it's really the Olympic trials. It's the Olympic trials, right? Because you have to qualify to go to this event, and then you have to do something at that event to make the Olympic team, because it's not like the pool where we just can put two in every event, because then there would be like way too many people in the race.
Right. I see. And then 2012 is when you made the Olympics, and I believe that was the London Olympics, correct?
Yeah. And it's not when I actually qualified in 2011, because I won our national championships, our world championship trials. Uh-huh. And then I went to world championships and I got fourth place, which qualified me for the Olympic Games.
For the Olympic Games. Got
yeah.
it.
But the actual games were in 12.
And so that was your big shot. What were your feelings about that Olympic performance? And do you have any, I mean, what place did you come in there, and do you have any regrets?
So I ended up 10th place. I have, you know, mixed feelings about the experience. I mean, it's kind of a long story, but, you know, first of all, I qualified a year in advance, and it's just that amount of time, for at least for me, was just, you know, like when our pool team qualifies, I think part of what makes why the USA performs so well at the Olympic Games is because, one, we're the best swimming team on the planet, maybe the best sports team ever. Yeah. And in that, you know, we've won the medal count for the last, I don't know how many Olympics, right? It's been a decade since the USA has not been on top of the medal count. But so just making that team is such a huge moment for people. Mm-hmm. And even for veterans, such a relief to just be done with trials and just to get through that. And now you can focus on the games. And it's in close time proximity to the games themselves. It's usually about a month. So okay. We kind of go and we're kind of like the thorn in FINA's side on this whole thing, because like every other federation does their trials a lot sooner than us. We're always like the last ones to kind of actually bend the rules a little bit. But anyway, spreading that, carrying that momentum of making the team into the Olympics, I think there's something to be said for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas for me, it was a little different in that I had over a year, and that meant I also was the first swimmer to make the team. So, you know, I got a little bit of extra kind of media sponsored attention, whatever, because of that. And then my whole life was just like Olympics. Yeah. And like, don't get me wrong, I, you know, this was my lifelong dream. I was ecstatic to be on that team, and, you know, a little bittersweet, a little heartbroken, because, you know, my friend Fran had passed away about a year before I made the team. Actually, not even that. about like 9 months. And we always thought that, or kind of hoped that we would go together. So, you know, it was a little bit of emotionally conflicting experience for me. And then also just virtue of the nature of my sport or my event, I had different training requirements from a lot of the pool swimmers. So I had this long period of just kind of like waiting.
Yeah.
And then in addition to that, when it got closer to the actual games, I didn't actually join up with the pool team for training camp and all that stuff because they were in like Knoxville, Tennessee, which turns out I actually lived there later from like 2014 and 2016. I trained at UT Knoxville. But I didn't go there. I didn't go to wherever they did their, I think it was Nice, France, which would have been pretty cool. But but I just kind of went and did my own thing because I felt like, no, I have specific needs training wise. And right. The February before the games, I actually fell off my bike and broke my collarbone. So I was like out for 8 weeks. So
wow.
I felt this intense need to go to altitude, stay there for 4 or 5 weeks, train my ass off, and try to like make up for lost time. And so like that whole, I'm just setting the scene here for like my mindset going into it, which was still very much looking forward to it, but also wanting it to be over almost before it even started, which is a terrible thing to say. And I'm super grateful for the experience. And I look back on it with fondness and I'm really proud of it, but I know that I was capable of way better than 10th place. It's just there was a little bit of mental stuff there. There was definitely some physical stuff, you know, there, with just the accident and everything. And, I felt a lot of pressure because Haley won a silver medal the day before. So I felt a lot of pressure because of that. I had this like awkward last minute suit change that like was messing with my head during the race. And so it is what it is. Like, it's one race. I mean, and my career is a lot more than just, I'm not going to let my career be defined by my 10th place finish at the Olympics, which I know is well below what I was capable of, but the pieces kind of have to fall in place at the right time. And they just didn't for me. And that's totally fine. Right. And I'm at peace with it. And it was a great experience. And honestly, the best part of it was probably that I had, because I had a year where I had qualified for more than a year out, I had like 30 friends and family there. It was awesome. I probably had the biggest cheering section of like anyone at that Olympics. It was awesome. And I was just really grateful for the effort that my friends and family went to go be there for me and support me. All in all, it was a good experience. It was a little bittersweet, but
yeah,
I'm proud that I was there and I did my best. That's all I can say is I did my best and I just didn't have the magic that day.
Yeah. And I mean, just getting there, being an Olympian is just an incredible accomplishment. Now, when do they, so the swimming events are the first week, the pool swimming events. And then I wish they televised the open water more. On the international platforms. When is it the second week? Is that right?
It was on, actually, it was just we are just I believe like 5 or 6 days past the 10-year anniversary of that swim. It was on August 10th or August 11th or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think it was five or six days after the pool swimming competition had
been, right.
Yeah. Which may, again, just kind of it just fits into this theme of kind of isolation. You know, where like finally, you know, I was doing my own thing for like a year. Like I missed out. I didn't do the training camp with everyone. Finally got to be in the village with everyone, but I was rooming with my coaches and staff. It's like, I didn't even room with other athletes.
Yeah.
And then after the pool competition was over, they all moved out and went and partied for the rest of the week, as they should. And I'm still sitting there competing on like the second to last day of the games, and I'm trying to sleep at night, and everyone is, you know, the dorm rooms didn't have very good air conditioning. Actually, I don't think they had any air conditioning, so you had to kind of leave your windows open to not overheat in the middle of the night, and all you could hear was, "Woo!" You know, we're I mean, people are having a good time. And I'm like, God, I still have to compete, damn it! Can you guys
right,
keep it down out there, or just be a little more respectful. So yeah, just that all kind of just goes.
One of the best in the world, and that's one thing you can be proud of. And so, whether it be that or any of the, you know, the world championship gold medals, what are you most proud of? Or anything in your professional life, what are you most proud of?
I would say, I'm most proud of, I think that I've made a pretty good effort to kind of give back in different ways. You know, I've served on some committees with USA Swimming and stuff. I've tried to be a mentor to some of the young up and comers and you know, kind of keep tabs on these younger guys that are still in it and you know, giving them some advice or whatever when they ask for it. But so that I mostly just want to be I feel like I represented the USA and the sport well and hopefully helped to kind of grow the sport a little bit. But as far as performance wise, I would say there's probably two that stick out, and it's kind of part of this grand story. And I would put these two performances as like bookends on my career, like where it really started and where it like really ended. And the first one was the World Championships in 2010. I won the 25K, so I became a world champion right after I graduated from college. So that was like, that was honestly probably like the best time of my life. I mean, I can't think of ever being any happier and like more fulfilled than I was at that point in my life. And part of what made that, this is kind of a long story. If you want me to, because there's a kind of a backstory.
Go into it.
Okay. So this might take a little bit. Listeners, just know this is, this will be like 15 minutes or so, but, so it really kind of started with, I told you like if the first eye opener was the Roy and Claire DeBoer talking about Cayuga Lake Swim, the second one was that 2009 period where I did that camp and made my first national team and went to Rome and, you know, canceled my summer school course that I was going to go take and said, sorry, I'm going to go do what I love more than anything. So 2009, I'm swimming the 25K and I literally just did my first 10K like a month before that. And I'm in Rome doing a 25K with like these international professional swimmers. And I'm feeling like, this is a huge step up for me. I honestly didn't even really feel that out of my league at all. I probably should have, but I felt pretty confident. And I was like, it just felt like I've never had so much opportunity at my fingertips ever. Like I have nothing, absolutely nothing to lose. No one knows who the hell I am. No one cares. And I actually think I can beat a lot of these people. So I had a pretty good mindset going into it. And these races are typically around a course. These days the course is a little shorter than they used to be, but it pretty much used to always be a 2,500 meter course. So 10K is four times around, 5K is two times around, 25K is 10 times around.
Wow.
When they do 25Ks, they typically stagger they do men and women on the same day. And they will stagger the start. So they'll send it, call it a half hour loop. They'll send the men first and they'll send the women like 5 minutes behind. And that's just kind of how it's
right.
Anyway, so actually this is kind of funny. This is my first 25K. And actually I'll just briefly, my first open water race ever I thought that it was a 5K at Nationals in like 2005 or something like that. I thought that, oh, this is an hour long swim. Everyone's just going to get off to a nice AC start, right? No. You sprint at the beginning because you want to get a good position in the pack, right?
Like, right.
Yeah, not up there, maybe not right at front, but not too far back. And so I learned that lesson the hard way because I just got absolutely trampled. I basically was like inhaling water and I was like underneath this stampede of swimmers. I could not come up for air. It was actually a little bit scary.
I know that feeling.
I learned that lesson the hard way. And then every race, you just, as soon as the gun goes off, you sprint your ass off. But fast forward to this 2009 World Championships, 25K, gun goes off. And I just start balls to the wall, just sprinting my ass off over to the next buoy. And I swim for about 50 meters and I realize there's no one around me. And then I look back, I stop and I look back and everyone's just la-di-da, just kind of cruising around. Yeah. Oh, okay. So when you do the long swims, it doesn't really matter that much. Got it. So I was kind of that, people were probably pointing and laughing at me. Whatever. So the race goes on and I'm feeling pretty good. And at one point, it's an hour into the race or so. And there's this guy who swims up behind me and PG 13 warning here. This guy, Valerio Clary, is an Italian swimmer, very good swimmer, comes up to me and to put it bluntly, grabs me by the balls, like really hard. And I was like, you know, I'm obviously very green in this whole sport. I just was the guy who just sprinted off the starting line for a 5.5 hour race. And I'm like, I turn around and I'm in complete disbelief. Like, and this was not like a figuratively speaking, like grab life by the balls. Like he literally grabbed me by the balls, like,
was this an anger thing or?
I don't know. To this day, I don't know. Have a minor confrontation with him later that evening.
What?
I didn't get any answers out of him either because we were both. Yeah, whatever. So I was just like totally shocked. So I didn't really know what to do, but I just kind of like kicked him off of me. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't realize that's how it goes at this level. Like, okay, that's a little weird, but I mean, if people are physical, that's, you know, elbows and all that stuff. Like that's one thing, but that's just seems like really weird. So anyway, I kind of shook it off and that never happened again in my career, by the way. So it's not a normal thing. I'm like, dude, we got 4.5 hours left in this thing. What are you doing? Anyway, we continue about the race and fast forward towards, call it half an hour to go. Three guys kind of broke away. And I was essentially the first chase person. So I was the closest guy to those top three that kind of broke away. And just imagine there's a lot of pack dynamics, like watching cycling or something like that. So,
right.
I'm kind of like swimming along and, you know, it's getting to the point where I'm halfway through this loop. I've got like 15 minutes left in the race and I accidentally, like all of a sudden I'm about to go around this buoy and I just bam, like land there. There was huge, huge swells. They were like 3 or 4 foot swells and like big jellyfish and we were getting stung and like tossed all over the place. It was like a washing machine in there. And anyway, I land on top of this woman, Shelley Clark. Actually, she was an Australian swimmer. I knew her personally and I ran right into her and totally by accident, I did not even see her there. But like I mentioned before, sometimes they'll stagger the starts. So
right.
It sometimes in the longer races, the faster men will catch the slower women. I mean,
right.
Geez, imagine if getting lapped in a pool is bad, like imagine getting lapped on a 2,500 meter course.
Wow.
that's pretty tough. But anyway, it was totally accidental. I didn't think anything of it. And I continued about my business. I'm kind of like, I'm pretty squarely in fourth place here. Like there's no one really in front of me. There's no one really behind me. So I'm kind of cruising along and I'm about 100 meters from the finish line. And I see the official's boat pull up to me with a red card, which is basically, if anyone who's watched soccer, it's kind of like yellow
penalty.
Red is you're out.
Wow.
So, and I'm like, what the hell? I haven't even seen it. There's no one even around me. How can I possibly get a red card? Turns out it was because I ran into Shelly, which is a complete accident. So it was total bullshit. And you know, I did the right thing, I think. And by getting out and walking the 100 meters or whatever left, although now looking back on it, I should have just swam through and protested, but whatever, I'm over it. I got out and I was really, really mad because not only did I feel like that was just totally unfair, but I also learned that Valerio Clary, the Italian guy, won the race.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like double pissed off at this point. And I do distinctly remember, though, having I got a big confidence boost from that. Cause I was like, you know what, man, you literally did your first 10K like a month ago and you just went to world championships and swam at 25K and basically got fourth place. That's pretty good. And I told one of my coaches, Catherine Vogt, who is a USC coach, that I was like, you know what? I think I can win next year. And I just remember being, despite the fact that I was really angry and upset, and I remember being just like bursting with confidence. So fast forward to the next year, and it's the 10K where we are in this town called Roberval, Canada, in Quebec. Like, it's like 3 hours north of like Quebec City. And this town is particularly interesting because it's like 10,000 people in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of cattle and blueberry fields. Like, that's it. But every July, they have this event called the Traversée Internationale du Lac Saint-Jean, which is the crossing of Lac Saint-Jean. And this race has a tremendous backstory and history. And for me personally, some of my closest mentors, in particular, Paul Asmuth, used to swim that race back in the 80s. And like, if you win the Traversée, you're like the man there. Like this community balloons from like 10,000 people to like 50,000 people for this race in July. And they have like parades and
wow.
Someone told me that, oh, if you win, that there's going to be at least like 10 children that year named after you because you won the Traverse, like all this crazy stuff. Like, they go nuts for it. They take 2 weeks off of work and they party. And yeah, it's insane. It is.
How many kilometers?
So it's 32 kilometers.
32. Wow.
That was like the weekend after the world championships that were also in Roberval. So I'm going to world championships and I'm there to swim the 25K again. And in the meantime, the 10K was like a few days before the 25K and Valerio won. So Valerio is now the reigning 10K and 25K world champion. So he's kind of like the man. And so fast forward to like the 25K race, which is the last one of the championships. And it's this big, long battle. It was a really hard race. That water is really cold. It was really rough. And it's even a longer story than that. I'll spare you though, but basically it comes down to, tell you the last lap where Valerio has broken away and I spent like 20 minutes catching up to this guy. And I'm like, and I caught him with like one lap to go, like half an hour to go. And I remember getting on his feet and drafting. And he just continued to let me draft off him for a while. And at one point it kind of dawned on me is like, he probably just doesn't know that I'm here. Cause this guy is not the type of guy to just let someone kind of sit back there.
Apparently not. You're a ball grabber.
Exactly. So I kind of put that together. I was like, I think he thought that he was so far away that he discounted everybody, stopped paying attention, and he doesn't know that I'm literally inches behind him. And that's why I said, whatever you do, don't touch his feet.
Yeah, don't give it away.
Normally, when you're drafting off of someone swimming, like every maybe 10 or 20 strokes, you'll like touch their toe a little bit or whatever. So, you know, that went well for about another 10 minutes. And then I literally like my pinky fingernail touched his pinky knuckle. And he immediately stops, turns around and looks at me. And like, I don't think, you know, there's like a few experiences in life where you were just like, oh, I've never been more scared than that.
Yeah.
This was one of them for me. I can see it in my mind, like his glare at me. I was like, oh God, I am in big trouble now. So we kind of swim next to each other for the rest of this lap. And then it's just, we're trying to break away from each other, but we're both so exhausted and tired. We don't have any gas left in the tank. And basically fast forward to like the last 100 meters where he's in front of me and I try to make the pass and he cuts me off and I try to go around the other side and he cuts me off again. And it's this whole zigzag. And like this, imagine like, it's like a top gun dogfight,
right?
Like not nearly as cool and swimmers in the water. Right. So it was kind of that. There was actually some good video of it on YouTube and stuff, but anyway, I touched him out by like a second. So I find my way around and I touched him out. And I was like, that was just the ultimate satisfaction for me. One, because of just the whole story that he's told up to that. And I was just like, yeah, you want to, so I was proud of winning and beating his ass, but, there were so many times in that race where I wanted to quit and I wanted to give up. And I was even telling myself like, hey, you know, like he's really far in front of you. Like second place is really good, man. Like you're a world champ, silver medal. Like that's awesome. And that is totally true, but that's not the right mindset to be having when you're still in the race. So I was mostly proud of myself for just like for overcoming my own negative thoughts and self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge lesson for me kind of going forward in my career that had nothing to do with training or tactics or any of that stuff. It was just about the mental game. And I learned a big lesson that day. So I was really, really proud of that. And then to just like quickly kind of cap it off, that was 2010. I retired in 2016. I realized in 2015 after World Championships when two American men qualified for Rio that I wasn't going to be on the Olympic team, which, you know, at first was devastating, but there are other, I realized that, you know what, I've got a year. If I want to, it can take a year to go do some things that I've always wanted to do. I just haven't really been able to, or haven't fit into my schedule, or the training for a 32K just isn't really compatible with trying to make a living swing 10Ks and stuff like that. So
right.
I decided that Lac St. John was going to be my swan song. It was going to be my last race. And the deal was with me and Paul, who is a close friend and a dear mentor in my life. The deal was always that he always wanted me to do it because, you know, he has this really rich history with Roberval in that race. And you should read his book. It's called Marathon Swimming, the Sport of the Soul. It's really well written. And there are some chapters in there about, you know, about our swim in 2016, but it's mostly about kind of his career arc and everything that he did and all of his ups and downs. But anyway, the deal was always, he was always like, you should do Lac St. John this year. And I'm like, no, I can't. I got to train for 10Ks. I got to go to this or that, or I got to qualify for my stipend or whatever. And, but when I decided I want to do Lac St. John and I always said to him, the only way I'll do it is if you are there with me and you're in my boat, because every swimmer has their own, escort boat.
For feeding and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's a crossing. It's like a point A to point B crossing. You start in this river in this really cold river. The whole thing is really cold, but the river is especially cold because it's melted snow coming from the down from the mountains. But so I told Paul, I was like, I want to do Lac Saint Jean and I want you there. And he said, absolutely, wouldn't miss it. And you know, I decided to go train for that race. I needed some cold water training. So I went up to this camp Chicopee in Ontario, actually, which is camp that it's like an old school summer camp that's kind of swimming focused. It was actually started by Matt Mann, who is one of the old Michigan varsity swim team coaches. But my coach Roy, who I told you about, took when we were like 12, he took us up there and we did a summer camp there. 1 year for a couple of weeks. And so that always felt, that was always a place that was close to my heart. And this whole performance was about like ending my career. It was about, and I'm a sentimental kind of person. I was like, I want to end this thing in like kind of this poignant or like almost poetic way. So I was like, I'm going to go to Camp Chicopee and I'm going to coach these kids for like a month. And I'm going to live dirty, you know, stinky cabins and bunks, and I'm going to sit around at the mess hall with all the kids and tell stories and jokes and all that stuff and sing the camp songs and do the whole thing. So I did that. And so that was kind of like, felt like closing wrapping up a story in like a nice tight little neat little package. But so I did that, and I went to Lac Saint Jean, and the funny thing is, or the cool thing is, that the Thursday or something, yeah, Wednesday or Thursday before the race on Saturday, they do this thing called they have this huge party basically mm-hmm. in downtown Roverball, which is like, you know, a few streets, but still they line up like 100 folding tables, literally the whole town, no one is home. The whole town brings dinner, like food, and everyone like breaks bread together in this.
Wow.
They call it the dinner in the streets. And it's literally one long table that's like a mile long, and everyone is there eating together, and there's bands and face paint, and like, it's like a carnival. It's insane. Like you have to see it to really know what I'm talking about. But they do this ceremony where it's kind of the end of the night, where everyone picks their out of a hat, goes up on stage in front of all these people, and you draw your, they have all the boat captains up there on the stage, and you go up there one at a time, you draw a name out of a hat, and that's your boat captain. Okay. And when I went up onto the stage, I pulled out the name Francois Bouillet, and turns out that was Paul's boat captain. Either the first or the last year that he swam Lac Saint Jean. So I was like, this is already just coming together in ways.
Wow.
And you know, and I just had a really good feeling about it. So fast forward to the actual race, and as I mentioned, it's really cold, and it was a really gray, drizzly, nasty day.
50 degree water temp.
Probably 57, 56, 57 and this is freshwater too, which is, you know, more, it sucks the heat out of you quicker than salt water. So 56 degree freshwater is way worse than 56 degree salt water. I don't know why, but it is. So after about 2 hours in, I'm starting to get like really cold. And Paul had at least one really close call in this lake where someone basically saved his life. Like he was hypothermic. He passed out while swimming. Someone had the presence of, was paying enough attention and had the presence of mind to kind of grab him. And
this is wetsuits.
No wetsuits.
Wow. No
wetsuits. They do allow wetsuits now, but not, when I was there, they just had a lower limit and no wetsuits were allowed.
Wow.
That part of the course was definitely below FINA's allowed minimum temperature, but that's a whole separate topic. Anyway, so a couple hours in, and I'm starting to take a real turn, like mentally and physically. I'm like, you know what? I was like, I don't think I'm going to finish this race. This sucks. Like, not only am I incredibly uncomfortable, Paul came all the way here. Paul's probably nervous right now because he almost died here. You know, I know I'm in good hands. I know there's people watching me, so I'm not worried about that. But like, man, what a bummer, right? This was supposed to be my swan song. This is my farewell. And I'm going to not even finish the race. Like, fuck. So I said, just swim for 2 more minutes and then you can get out. So I swam for 2 more minutes and then I was like, all right, just swim for 2 more minutes and then you can get out.
Right.
Yeah. So I swam for 2 more minutes and I did that for about 2 hours. So yeah, I guess, 60 times. And that is like, again, I think I attribute a lot of just like the mental lessons that I've learned and just trying to overcome that negativity and talk yourself into it and kind of like come up with these little mental hacks or little tricks to kind of keep yourself going. But
that works. Anyway. It works with biking and also running too. Oh, just run there, just run a kilometer. And then before you know it, you just did 10 miles.
Yeah. You just got to, exactly. You got to break it up into smaller chunks. So it's a lot more digestible and palatable that way. So, so finally, like I'm starting to, you know, I do that, but then like the sun comes out and with the farther away you get from the river, the warmer the water is. So the water started to warm up just a little bit to like 61, 62, which felt balmy compared to the 57 degree water. And then I just felt like I was climbing back up from rock bottom. And the sun was out and then like all these boats were flying around. Like that's the other cool thing is there's 25 participants and there's like 200 boats, like private boats that are following this race across the lake. It's crazy. Like people love this thing. I can't explain it to you really that well without you actually witnessing it, but it is quite a scene. And I remember one turning point was a boat came drove by with an American flag on the front. And I was just like, yes, yes, that is what I need right now. That pumped me up. I was so, so amped about that. And then I kind of looked up and I realized it was the Sebastian Trombly, who was actually my host. He hosted me at his home. Because this is a really community kind of based event and a lot of people host the athletes. But So that happened. And then I remember Paul had this little whiteboard where he would kind of communicate things to me. And it's basically me I'm swimming along. I'm kind of leaving out the competitive component, which is like when I was really cold, I was just in the middle of the pack with everybody. And finally, once I started feeling better, it was me and one other guy, Eduardo Stocchino, who's an Italian guy who I had raced a bunch of times. And I finally was able to kind of break away from him. Mm-hmm. And I'm swimming by myself. I see the American flag. I'm all amped. And then Paul pulls up the sign and he wrote on the whiteboard. He said, sun is with you. Waves are with you. Family is with you.
Nice.
And that it still gets me emotional just thinking about that. But like Paul's just the man. But I mean, that meant a lot, and that was just all that was all I needed. I was like, that's it, I'm done. Like, I'm gonna win this thing. And I'm gonna put that blue robe on, and I'm gonna stand up on the podium. I'm gonna hold that big ass trophy up in front of everybody. And I was unstoppable for the remaining probably hour of that race. And I would just left everyone in the dust and I felt good and my shoulder was killing me, but I didn't care.
Wow.
The race. So
that's an incredible story.
So, it was literally in the same exact finish structure, even in the same exact place as when I won that 25K in 2010, which I can kind of consider to be like my first big moment, you know, and this was like my last big moment. And in both of those races, I came really close to quitting or really close to maybe not getting out, but just kind of talking myself out of that competitive mindset or that champion mindset and just like, you know, accepting second place. Like, I'm not even going to try to pass this guy in 2010, right? Like, no, that's not what I did. You know, in 2016, I was really cold and I couldn't I couldn't pee, which is actually a really important thing. It sounds kind of silly, but it's actually a really important skill. And like, there are all these other things that were going wrong that I just didn't let sink my spirits at all. So I'm proud of those for the fact that I won, but even more proud of the fact that I kind of overcame myself in the process. And
you put the nice book in on an incredible career.
Right. Yeah. And, yeah. So I was like, that's nice and neat now. Like that, then now I can say, you know, started here, ended here. And Rubber Ball will always just hold a really special place in my heart.
Yeah. Wow.
So sorry, that's the long answer to
I love that. That was that's definitely worth it. And we're gonna have that your own explanation of that on the Endurance Experience podcast. People are gonna be calling this back up for many, many years. So that's great.
Cool.
So let's talk about see if we can tap into some of your swimming knowledge and open water swimming knowledge. So a lot of triathletes listen to this podcast, and swimming is generally the weakest of the three disciplines with triathletes. And so, you know, what advice can you give swimmers of any ability to become better open water swimmers? I mean, you talked a little bit in your story about some of the things like rough water, like sighting and drafting. One of the biggest things people have challenges with is the anxiety of open water, that sort of sympathetic system kicks in. Oh, no, there's no wall to hold on to.
Yep.
And then I've seen really good swimmers, pool swimmers, go in and panic. So generally, what advice do you have for swimmers to become better open water swimmers?
Yeah, I got a few things. I mean, one, I would say, yeah, the swim is the shortest component of the race. I mean, time wise, it's got to account for less than 10% of that. I would, you know, I'm not an expert on triathlons.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You're a small fraction. And I think therefore it just intellectually makes sense that, oh, I should focus my training efforts on the other 90% of the race. But what I would say that, and I know that a lot, that's the perspective that a lot of people have, and not saying that all of you folks that are listening that are triathletes do it that way or approach it that way, but I know that a lot do. And I would say that sure, there is kind of like economically speaking, that does kind of make sense. But what you are not really taking into account is that the swim is the first part of your race. And just as much as, you know, like when you meet someone, they say like first impression, like you have 10 seconds to make a good first impression.
Right.
People kind of make up their mind whether they like you or not, like the first 10 seconds of meeting you or the first sentence that comes out of your mouth. I would say there's something to be said for the fact that how you feel in the swim and how you perform in the swim kind of sets the tone for the rest of your race. Similar to one of the things that my old coach used to tell me is that the first stroke of when you break out, basically when you come to the surface after pushing the wall, the first stroke of every length of the pool is especially crucial and he called it the set stroke, because it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the strokes that are in that length, because humans, both in body and mind, have a way of kind of getting in a groove and staying in that groove.
Yeah.
And so I would just say, first of all, I would rethink that attitude or perspective a little bit about it's not sure. It is a small component of the race, but it's also the first one. And I think that should, that makes it a little bit more important than it would otherwise be based on the sheer amount of calories you expend or the time that you spend doing that leg of the race.
Right.
And just especially the longer ones, like that story I just told you, if anything, a story of like mental resilience, that's a really important factor. And if you get off on a bad foot mentally, that can really sour the rest of your, that could ruin a performance, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you try to just skate by with doing the bare minimum, it's like, yeah, I'll just get through the swim. That's not going to put you in a very good mindset getting on the bike. You're going to feel like,
man, especially Ironman swim. Yeah. I mean, Ironman, well, it's 4,200 yards, which would be nothing for you, but the average Joe doing 4,200 yards. Yeah. Maybe you can't win, but you can certainly lose it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so that's the first part. The second part is just very simple. Just swim more.
Right.
Just go swim more, swim with people that are better than you, swim in an environment if you can, and if you have access to it, that's somewhat structured, like a master's team or a triathlon group that goes out together as a group and does the stuff, you know, like misery loves company, as they say. And I know for certain when I go down the street to the Y and try to go get a swimming workout in on my own, I get to like 3,000 yards. I'm like, I think I'll be done now. But when I'm at an actual practice, 5,000 yards flies by very quickly. And so just that kind of group mentality and aspect, I think, at least for me personally, helps push you to do a little bit more and therefore prepare better. But also go in open water and put your whatever you're going to wear, whether it's a tri-suit or a wetsuit or whatever, use your actual equipment in a venue that's somewhat similar to where you're going to be racing and go swim there. A lot of people just go to the pool all the time and think, oh, it's a 1200 yard swim or whatever. I just did 1200 yards in the pool. I'll be fine. It's just not the same.
Right.
It's just really not. Yeah. And especially when you've got a wetsuit that's somewhat constricting around your chest, which can cause panic. When the water's cold, which in addition to the, you know, the tightness can like, I mean, people have heart attacks because of that.
Yeah.
Like, you have to just familiarize yourself with as close to the actual environment as you can possibly like replicate.
Right.
So swim more, swim with other people, and try to replicate your race environment as much as possible.
Yeah. And what about sighting and drafting? And how did you tune your craft to get better at this? This could be something that's very helpful as an open water swimmer to stay on course, minimize how much work you have to do.
So for the sighting piece, I would say one, it's pretty technical and it's pretty specific to the person. I mean, there's a couple different ways I sight, whether it's trying to do it while whether it's as you're recovering, as you're kind of looking up, as your one arm is coming over, trying to pop your head up at the same time,
versus
in between strokes. So that's what I typically do. If I'm not sprinting, I'll actually in between strokes, I'll just do a quick like gator eyes, like quick pop up and down. I don't even take my mouth or my nose doesn't even come out of the water.
Right.
Quick sight with just enough goggle out to see where you're going. When in rough water, that's a little bit harder, but so I would say experiment with different techniques, but honestly, for most people, unless you're going to be one of the top, one of the swimming leaders, just follow the people in front of you. Don't just focus on drafting well. Sight enough where you're not going to like totally swim past the end of the course. Like if all of a sudden you're behind someone and there are a bunch of people and then there's like no one in front of you anymore, you probably missed a buoy, right? But so don't be completely unaware, but I would worry less about the sighting aspect. Definitely practice it. You'll get the hang, just practice it and you'll get the hang of it.
Right.
You'll figure out what works for you. Just do it in the pool. You don't have to be in open water to do it. Do it in the pool. Do it like just dry on land. Just, you know, you can kind of experiment with ways that everyone does it slightly differently. So that, but also drafting is hugely important. It can save you a lot of time and energy. I would say practice with a friend, just take turns. saying, okay, you follow me, I follow you. Try to, what a lot of people do try to do when they're drafting is they try to sight to look up and see the person in front of them. You do not need to do that.
Yeah.
You have hands that can feel where their kick is coming from. You have eyeballs that can see the little bubbles that the person's kick makes who's in front of you. And you can follow that. There's all these other cues that you can use to follow somebody closely and not have to look up and literally see them with your eyeballs every three strokes.
I think probably some people are less convinced that that person knows what they're doing. Right.
Sure. So, you do have to kind of trust a little bit, but like it's at least in my experience, I mean, I can't say I've watched a ton of triathlons, but like for the most part, people stay mostly on course.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know very quickly whether or not someone knows what they're doing and then you can stay on their feet.
Yeah. And even if they're a little bit off course, they might add over a, even in an Ironman over a 2.4 mile swim, they might add 100 meters, maybe. That's right. Even kind of a lot. They might add 100 meters to their distance and call that, all right, a minute and a half. But like what you made up by drafting off of them is like you saved a lot of energy doing that too, right? So that's like a worst case scenario. So I would focus more on drafting well than sighting well. And one thing I like to do with people is one, just like understand that everyone naturally tends to go left or go right a little bit. And that's totally, totally fine. Like same with walking, right? Like if you and I went out into the desert and we put blindfolds on and they said, walk a straight line for a mile, like one of us would probably go like one direction. One of us would probably go complete opposite direction. We'd be all over the place. We would not walk a straight line. No one's perfectly symmetrical. And that's totally fine. You just have to know yourself and know how you naturally tend to go. One way I like to kind of figure that out is if you have a swim snorkel with one of the ones that goes in front of your kind of in front of your face, put one of those on. If you ideally either like a long course pool or a lake or pond or something like that, just pick like a spot on the horizon if you're in open water or the end of the lane if you're in a 15 meter pool and just close your eyes and just start swimming and try to go like swim your natural stroke. Don't think about trying to swim straight. Just swim your natural stroke and do that like 10 times. Mm-hmm. And then when you lift up, stop, you know, when you hit the lane line, I mean, maybe count your strokes if you're in a pool, if you don't run on the end of the lane, but if you do run at the end of to the wall on the other side, then you're probably swimming pretty straight. That's pretty impressive. Right. I doubt I could swim with my eyes closed for 50 meters without hitting a lane line. So just experiment with it. Do some eye closed kind of experiments. Figure out how you naturally tend to go. And then you can start working in your breath. And because breath, which side you breathe to can also influence how you kind of steer. So me, for example, I know I tend to go left a little bit with breath out of the equation. When I breathe to my left, I go a little more left. When I breathe to my right, I go a little more right. That is not the same for everyone, by the way. Sometimes if people who breathe, when they breathe left, they tend to go more right. This is very individual or very specific to the individual. So I know that when I'm breathing to my left, I have to be careful because I tend to go left. And my left breathing makes me go left. So that's like double left. So I need to pay more attention. When I'm breathing right, my left tendency is kind of counterbalanced by my right side breathing. So I tend to naturally swim more straight. That is very specific to me.
And in competition, did you do bilateral or did you just switch to one side only?
I breathe to both sides, but I breathe every other stroke. So I'll breathe to my left for a while and I'll breathe to my right for a while. And I'll
got it
for a while. I probably favor my right side, but I definitely breathe. You have to know how to breathe on both sides.
Yeah.
You can, you should work on that.
Right.
So that's probably the best advice I can give. And also if you're drafting off of someone, just understand that they're kind of doing you a favor. So just don't like touch their feet on like every stroke. Like if you don't touch their feet at all, you're probably not close enough to them. Like you should touch their feet every 20, 30 seconds or something like that. Maybe 30 seconds. But the farther away you get from their feet, the less and less of a draft. Like that slipstream is really not very big. So you actually have to be really close to them to get the full effect. If there's 2 feet in between your fingertips and their toes, that is too much space. You are not getting the full effect. You have to be a little bit closer than that. But obviously don't be all over them, because then they're just going to either kick you in the face or they're going to roll over and say, you know what, dude, you go. I'm tired of this.
Well, grab your balls.
Yeah, or that.
That's great advice. All right. Let's finish up and talk about what you're excited about in swimming generally, or who you're excited about as we look forward to, you know, another Olympics coming up right around the corner. Yeah. And also you have I wanted to ask you about your marathon swimming ranking system and give you a chance to talk about that and how that came about.
They're kind of related in that, like, I would say that there are a couple folks that I'm interested in watching come up through the ranks. Is, well, I have to say that the U.S. national team is certainly in a developmental period. A lot of our veterans and more experienced athletes are either recently retired or about to retire, and our national team is mostly pretty young people. And this is actually, it reminds me a lot of 2009, when it was basically Fran Crippen and Chip Peterson, who were kind of the OGs on our national team in Rome. Mm-hmm. And everyone else was, I think everyone else was there for their first national team ever. And we actually, over the years, that team, there wasn't a lot of turnover in that team. And I don't remember what year, but I think we scored the most points at world championships in open water. We were the best open water team. So I'm really interested to see what guys like the Gravely brothers, Brennan and Dylan, Joey Tepper, who's at Tennessee. You know, I spent a little time there. Guys like Michael Brinninger, who's probably better known for his pool swims, but does some open water stuff. And guys like Simon Lamar, who is a Harvard swimmer, who's done really well with his open water recently, and also David Heron, who's a good friend of mine. We trained together at Tennessee, and he's still kind of, I would say he's more or less in that veteran position right now, and I think he's still got some good swims left in him. So none of them are ranked particularly high right now. I think Brennan is our highest ranked at 46th in the world. Dylan is 63rd. Joey is 67th, and then down from there. But there are other up and comers that are interesting too, like Romanchuk, who's the Ukrainian distance swimmer, mostly known for his pool swims, again, just started doing some open water stuff, and he's had some good results. Now, he's not ranked super high right now because you kind of have to do a few races to kind of work your way up through the rankings, kind of prove yourself. But that'll be really interesting to see. I would love to see Bobby Fink try out some open water stuff, but I don't know if he's our best pool distance swimmer right now. Won gold in the 800 mile in the last Olympics and had a good world championships and stuff. So I don't know if we'll see that, but also there's a young kid, Sasha Velli, I believe he's a French guy who's risen through the ranks relatively quickly recently. And on the women's side, it's always like great to watch Ana Marcela Cunha from Brazil, who's been just so dominant for so long, but also she's got, I think she's number two in the world right now. And Leonie Beck, German athlete, has put together some really good performances in just the last few years. And she's, I believe, at number one. So, or she is at number one. And it was great to see Sharon Van Roondel, who is who won world championships recently, who hadn't really won a major race in a couple of years. So some interesting stuff happened on the women's side too. But this is all kind of the reason I know about this is because I've been following these results, because I, over the last really couple of years or so, took it upon myself to create a world ranking system for open water swimmers. And, you know, it's something that, you know, rankings in general, basically every major legit professional sport has some ranking system of some kind. And it is especially important for sports that don't take place in a controlled environment. So like track and field, the 100 meter dash is like it's just your time, right? Like is a track pretty much no matter where you go. Obviously there's some minor differences, but like same as, you know, the 200 IM, like a pool of 50 meters in this pool is the same distance as 50 meters in this other pool, and water is water. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of the same thing. So you can kind of just use that time as this universal measuring stick, or, you know, like a high jumper or a shot put distance throw, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, but these other sports like tennis or golf or alpine skiing, they all have established, generally accepted world ranking systems.
Right.
And they are an essential part of the sports infrastructure, in that they, one, help athletes and coaches understand their progress in a empirical and unbiased way, right? Like when you win a tournament or you win an open water race, like, okay, am I getting better or not? Or like based on how you play. So you get like fifth place in some race. Does that mean I'm getting better or am I not getting better? It's hard to say. And if you're swimming a 200 free, the time kind of is it. So that it's a much clearer way to measure your abilities and your performance. Whereas whereas rankings for this other sports kind of serve that purpose, and that it helps people understand kind of where they sit. Also, it helps, you know, NGB, national governing bodies and international federations make selection decisions, whether it's FINA selecting the athletes that go to the Olympics, or whether it's USA Swimming selecting the athletes that go to world championships. You know, that a ranking could have an application there. Mm-hmm. Other sports use rankings for stuff like that. Same as like sponsors or NGBs or whatever will incentivize their athletes that way. Say, oh, if you're so-and-so, you're ranked this in the world. If you rank into the top 10, we'll pay you X number of dollars and whatever. And it's part of your contract with Nike or whatever. Right. And also just the rankings are thing. It's just data that people are becoming more and more data minded. And it's just think about how much people geek out over like football stats.
You're right.
There's nothing like that in open water swimming right now. I mean, until now, because I've created this ranking system.
Now,
right?
did you create the underlying metrics that the ranking is based upon?
Right. Yep, I do. I did. And it's basically every, I use, for those of you out there that are interested in this stuff, I actually implemented a page rank algorithm that basically weights certain aspects of athletes' performances. So basically what that means is what matters is your performances and who you beat and who beat you and where you did it, meaning like what level of competition you did it at. Was it at the Olympics or World Championships, or was it at some random, like some less important event? And then also, how long ago was it? Like a result from yesterday means a lot more than a result from 6 months ago, which means a lot more than a result from 2 years ago, which some may say is irrelevant, right? So you kind of control for that. And that's basically how it's pretty complicated. You can, if you want to, if anyone who wants to learn more about how it actually works can go to marathonswimrankings.com, which is the kind of where I explain everything. And also my Instagram is at marathonswimrankings, where I just kind of every month I'll just kind of post the updates and I'll kind of show a month over month change. And it really does stir some interesting conversation, and I try to listen to as much of the commentary as possible and kind of just really feel out like the feedback that people are giving and you know what other applications are there for this type of data. And I've been producing some pretty interesting using the ranking data in combination with the results data to kind of create some pretty cool like they're basically charts. Like I'm not going to try to glorify it. They're charts, but they tell a story, and it's actually has surprised me how interesting some of these, cause I'm collecting all the results data for all the major open water competitions, including people's time. So I can show like cool, like head to head matchup data. I can show someone's like world ranking progression over time. I could show like the actual rating values that goes into that ranking and say like, oh, who's catching who or who's falling down, yeah, surpassed, stuff like that, which if I only published the rankings, like you wouldn't know that the guy in fourth place is about to pass the guy in third place, but the guy in second place is miles ahead of the guy in third place. Right. So, so there's some interesting stuff there. And what I really want is for to make this available to athletes and coaches for them to use to just, like I said before, mostly just better understand how did this one race affect my ranking, and what types of conditions do I do better or do not as well? How do I tend to fare against so-and-so, and like you can clearly tell there's just a lot there. Yeah. And it's provided some really interesting and kind of surprisingly interesting insights that I think would be really valuable to share with the community. So I'm kind of in the process of building some other tools for people to like actually really dive into that data and use it and apply it. But right now it's more or less just the ranking. And I'm in conversations with FINA about the International Federation about, you know, them kind of adopting this methodology. Cause honestly, I do feel like, you know, it probably should come from them. This should be at least some kind of like work. This should be published or produced by a group of people, not necessarily just me. And I have credibility and standing in the community, but I'm still just one person. You know, I have my own ideas, and someone else may feel very differently about some aspect of the method than me. And this should be a collaborative kind of process. So, to make it the most fair. So,
I have a background in data science. Do you have a background in data science as well?
I've done all this by just sheer grit, right, and figuring it out and banging my head against the wall until the solution comes to me. And I've always been like an analytical person or a data comfortable with just numbers and you know, stuff like that, just quantitatively kind of, but
well, I was going to say
no formal training whatsoever.
This is, mastery of some pretty massive data sets.
Yeah.
And, you know, just taking a look at some of the graphs on the site, that's, you know, data visualization, which is a new way of depicting data to get better insights about what's happening. You seem to have figured it out just on your own.
Yeah.
So very impressive.
I would love to eventually be like, maybe this thing could generate some revenue so I could kind of hire an actual real, you know, software engineer or data scientist to kind of fine tune some of this stuff and make it a little more efficient or whatever. But for me, or at this point, it's just me. And I'm actually having a lot of fun with it and just learning some computer programming and stuff like that. But mostly I feel like, you know, I'm combining a couple things that I enjoy and I'm good at. One being the, you know, an open water swimming athlete, another being, you know, a data minded kind of curious person. Mm-hmm. And I've always felt like that open water swimming in a lot of Olympic sports are very underserved in that data department. And like all the major league sports, you know, football, basketball, baseball, soccer, whatever, like they're huge multi-billion dollar industries. They've got people that are incredibly talented, savvy, smart data analysts that can crank out these stats in the snap of a finger. They have like an entire office of people sitting there during broadcast for basketball games, like at the ready with all these stats that might be relevant to what just happened in that game 10 seconds ago. You know, a lot of Olympic sports, we have just as much of a need for data. There may not be as many data points to really gather, but we still stand to benefit from having easy access to that. And right now, for a lot of sports, it's just not there. There's nowhere you can go to see someone's world ranking progression over time until now. There's nowhere that you can know if like did my fourth place at that Len Cup 2 weeks ago, did that help my ranking or hurt it? Like there's no way to know that. And there has been a way to know that until now. So there may be opportunity to expand into other sports. I'm particularly interested in like race data from like endurance sports. I think there's a lot there. Not so much like biometric data, or there's a lot of that going on. I'm not as into that. I'm more about like actual performance stats. Are interesting. I don't really care. Like what actually that's not true. Like it might be interesting to see like someone's heart rate, you know, kind of layered over different parts of a marathon or something.
Right.
Like, that's another issue for another day, but, so that's what I'm working on right now. It's been a lot of fun. I think it provides and will provide, a lot of even more value in the future. And this is just kind of one of my ways of just giving back a little bit and helping grow the sport and really just legitimize and professionalize the sport.
And I hopefully it will shed some more light on open water swimming. Like we all know about Caleb Dressel and Katie Ledecky and all, you know, the big names, but you just rattled off some names that some of those folks I'd never heard of. But I wish we had more visibility into what's going on in open water swimming, just, you know, giving it its due attention. So
And the other cool thing is that like I can collect results from going, I can go back in time to when like Fran and I were swimming, or back when Paul was swimming, and I could apply the same methodology to old results and kind of have a window into the past and be like, there's a lot there. I'm turning over new stones all the time, and you know, sometimes I'll go chasing for something and it's just like there's really nothing there, and sometimes you'll get an idea about something and you kind of put it together and you're just like, wow, actually that's really insightful, or that's really cool, or that's totally the opposite of what I expected, or something like that. So
yeah
it's fun.
All right, Alex, well, you have been very generous with your time, and we've covered a lot of ground. Where could people find you? I think you mentioned your handles. What's the best platform for people to find you on? And we all know, marathonswimrankings.com is where you can find the information about the ranking system. But where do they find you?
Probably... I'm not the greatest Instagram user, but I'll get back to you if you reach out to me. It's Alex Meyer Swims on Instagram. So yeah, you can reach out to me there.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on to the podcast.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Tony. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks again to Olympic swimmer Alex Meyer for coming on to the Endurance Experience podcast. I'm glad I was able to give this little present to all the swimmers and open water swimmers out there. It was great to have that conversation with Alex and hear about his life, and in the process, give some great advice to all of the swimmers, triathletes, anyone looking to improve in their swimming. Don't forget to go to Alex's Instagram and follow him. Alex Meyer Swims on Instagram. And definitely go check out his swimming world ranking system that he developed. As a data guy, I can tell you that's pretty sophisticated. www.marathonswimrankings.com. Take a look at that. Lots of great podcasts coming up on the Endurance Experience. So I hope you tune in. Thanks again for listening.
Follow Event Horizon Endurance Sport on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for training programs and services to become a member of our Endurance Institute, or for a complete archive of podcasts, log on to our website, eventhorizon.tv.